Good morning. This is Joe Yates with the News Gazette covering Champaign, Urbana, Danville, and East Central Illinois, dated March 5th, 2021. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, "As Cases Fall, Health District Hanging On to Contact Tracers." This is a story by Deborah Pressey. As the numbers of currently active COVID-19 cases have recently fallen in Champaign County, the hectic workload for contact tracers has also tapered off. But with spring break and Easter ahead and students back in the bars, the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District is remaining on the cautious side in case contact tracing needs to be ramped back up again in a hurry. While contact tracers who leave these days aren't being replaced, none are being laid off either, according to Nancy Johnson, operations lead for the Health District's Emergency Operations Management Center. In early November, Champaign County had over 1,000 active cases. People had tested positive for COVID-19 and weren't yet considered recovered. As of Thursday, that number was down to 294, which is good news. It's the job of contact tracers to reach out and keep in touch with both those who newly test positive for COVID-19 and the people they were in close contact with. Johnson said the health district had 30 to 35 contact tracers on the job during the height of the pandemic last year, and contact tracing was going on 12 hours a day. These days, the district has about 15 to 20 contact tracers working about 8 hours a day. Contact tracing remains a 7-day-a-week job, Johnson said. It's definitely a lot slower, she said. At the current pace, contact tracers finally have more time to loop back with people in isolation and quarantine who opted to keep in touch by text or email rather than phone calls, but haven't done so consistently, Jantz said. There was a time when we did not have the capabilities to be doing that with anyone, she said. Vermilion County Health Administrator Doug Toole said contact tracers in that county were hired to cover more than just contact tracing, and now some of that staff of 11 is being assigned other tasks such as data entry and helping schedule vaccine appointments. We're finding other ways they can help us out, he said. The Ford County Health Department formerly had 3 contact tracers on the job and is now handling contact tracing with 2 people, said Megan Reuter, its community health educator. Contact tracing hasn't slowed down at all for Douglas County, which is the highest 7-day positivity rate in the region. The Douglas County Health Department has 4 contact tracers plus 2 managers handling the workload and is about to hire 1 more person to do both testing and contact tracing, according to department spokeswoman Summer Phillips. And that's the end of that story by Deborah Pressey. Now let's go to a story out of Monticello. City exploring development of new 30-acre recreation complex. This is a story by Steve Hoffman out of Monticello. Monticello Mayor Larry Stoner hopes a newly named committee can kickstart development of a 38-acre recreation complex on the west side of town. I find it necessary to designate a special committee, the 30-acre multi-use outdoor recreation committee, to study the factual economic impacts, current design elements, and needs assessment and funding opportunities associated with the development of Lot 402 of Apple Tree 4th Subdivision, Stoner told the City Council on February 22nd. The city bought the land in 2009 with the intent of developing it into a recreation area complete with ball fields, walking path, and a fishing pond. Progress has been slow, although the city has done some groundwork at the site. Alderman Mike Coon will chair the committee. Other members include Alderman John Friedrichs, and community members Amy Shawarko, Tiffany Coaster, Nicole Soper, Chris Patton, Heather Ball, and Aaron Tice. In naming the committee, Stoner stipulated that that issue is a report by October 15th. Various efforts have been undertaken over the past 12 years to develop the site. The city was initially using its own labor to get groundwork and infrastructure completed. The concern was shown over working around a large natural gas line that runs through the property. The latest try was from the Monticello Recreation Foundation, which formed its own committee to study the project, but could not raise the dollars needed for the estimated $10 million effort. City Administrator Terry Summers said the not-for-profit foundation is still on board with the project. However, they're excited about the recreation site and that they and what they can do to assist not only the committee, but all recreation and parks programs, Somerset. They're excited, and we're excited. How they got here. Here's a timeline regarding the 30.964 acres of city-owned land that was bought to establish the recreation complex. Going back to June 27, 2009, the City Council votes 4-2 to buy 31 acres from Greg Millage in the Apple Tree subdivision for $436,500. The goal is to construct baseball, softball, and soccer fields. Jumping ahead to July 25, 2011, a preliminary plan for the recreation facility was presented by John Vann and Steve Gonzalez of Land Tech. The preliminary plan had three ball diamonds, a retention pond that would be stocked for fishing, an exercise trail, one full and one half basketball court, two soccer football fields, and four smaller fields. A shelter and restrooms could be placed in the center of the complex due to space constraints. Tennis courts and a skate park were not included. December 9, 2013, a five-year, six-phase outline for development was included in a recreation master plan that was approved by the council. City Recreation Director Carlos McClellan said the document is a good planning tool and essential in qualifying for open space lands acquisition and development grants. June 22, 2015, about 50 spectators crowded the city council meeting, most in support of the recreation site. Local coach Justin Wiedner touted the economic impact of the Travel League tournaments. Depending on their schedule and how far they travel, they are going to spend the day here, maybe even the night. I can imagine the crowd at Filippo's already, Wiedner said. The Best Western would be full. But Marine Holt said the dollars estimated at $3 million at that point would be better spent on fixing sewer and drainage issues in the town. Aldermen voted down a motion 5-3 that would have halted work on the recreation site. City workers are doing preliminary work at the site, including partial excavation of the pond, along with the scraping to the hot topsoil and storing it for later phases of the project. Jumping ahead to September 29, 2015, the City Council opted against asking voters to fund the park's development, agreeing by consensus not to put a referendum on the March 2016 ballot. January 12, 2016, the 30 acres owned by the city could have ended up in the school district's hands as a possible site for a new high school. The land swap would have seen the city net the school's Wilkie Athletic Complex and Lincoln Elementary School in a deal. It was contingent on the voters approving the building referendum, which was defeated 2 months later. November 28, 2016, the on-again, off-again project to turn 30 acres of city-owned land on the west side of Monticello into a recreational facility was on again. Monticello Alderman Monday approved a resolution to continue funding the project, which had been on hiatus for more than a year. Jumping ahead to December 11, 2017, some city council members were having a crisis of faith when it came to the possibility of developing the west side land. When we get more information about the cost of developing the 30 acres, if that doesn't work out, I think we should sell it. Use the money for infrastructure projects, Alderman John Miller said. Alderman Joe Brown was also concerned about spending a potential $41,000 in preliminary engineering work. August 27, 2019, the Monticello Recreation Foundation took the mantle of fundraising and planning over for the project, now estimated to cost around $10 million if completely contracted out. We need your time, we need your wallet, Foundation volunteer Nathan Goble admitted to the audience. Discussions at the meeting included whether the current recreation complex design was set in stone, whether the volunteer labor could whittle the cost down from the estimated $9.2 million, and if there is a timeline for completion. December 2nd, 2019, an update to the City Council Foundation, board member Doug Lilly said it would take at least 2 years to raise the necessary funds for the recreation project, then another 2 years to construct it. October 19th, 2020, City Administrator Terry Summers broached the idea of hiring a fundraising expert campaign manager to kickstart the 30-acre Recreation Foundation project on the west side of edge of town, although no action was taken. Summers said only about $10,000 had been raised for the project at that point. And February 22nd, 2021, Mayor Larry Stoner appoints an 8-person economic committee to study the issue, including the economic impacts and current design, and report back to the City Council by October 15th. So that's the end of that story by Stephen Hoffman, and gives you an update on the development of the new 30-acre recreation complex. Let's go on to our next story. This is a story by Dave Hinton. This is the Champaign Fire Department. Firefighters earn awards for efforts in deadly 2019 blaze. This is a story out of Champaign, Illinois. In a ceremony that was delayed in part by the coronavirus pandemic, the Champaign Fire Department last week honored several firefighters for their efforts at a blaze more than a year ago at a house on Sherwood Court that left two people dead. In recounting the events, Lieutenant Jason Rector said, December 21st, 2019 had been a long day for the firefighters at Station 1. They had turned in about midnight and were asleep when a call came through about a working fire at the house in Sherwood with multiple children trapped inside. To wake up to something like that, it's a different feeling. It's hard to explain, he said. He knew he and fellow firefighter Josh Pless, would be among those tasked with doing the primary search and told Please to be ready. When we got there, probably a third of the house was fully involved, Rector said. We knew we had to move quick because that fire was growing at a very fast rate. The technique is called vent, enter, and search. At that time of a night, most people are in bed, so the firefighters focused on the bedrooms. They pretty quickly found one person, a middle-aged woman, unconscious in the northwest bedroom, and radioed their commander that they would be extracting her out the window. At that time, fire conditions were getting a lot worse, Rector said. I got on the radio and asked the incident commander, do we have any confirmation how many victims there are? No more information was available, so Please and Rector crawled down a hallway under heavy flames in an attempt to find others. At that point, Please's equipment malfunction forced him to leave the building, Chief Gary Ludwig said. Rector searched another bedroom and a bathroom where a teenage girl was found, also unconscious. He called for assistance, and firefighter Justin Kaiser entered and helped move the teen outside. A three-person search team was also looking for victims on the other side of the house. The story we got was there were four people in there, Rector said. It turned out one had left to stay the night at a neighbor's house, and another got out and ran to the neighbors to call 911. Emergency personnel administered CPR to both victims. Were breathing when ambulance took them to Carley Foundation Hospital. Unfortunately, both later died. We definitely gave them a fighting chance, but unfortunately they didn't make it, said Rector, a 12-year veteran of the Champaign Department. Please, also a 12-year firefighter, including 3.5 years in Champaign, said firefighters don't get too many calls like that one, but their training puts them in a position to be ready when it does come. We train for this all the time, he said. We train for going in to get victims, to get in, and to get out, Please said. Thankfully, it's not a high-frequency event, but when the time comes, it's time to fall back on everything you've trained for and do the job. Rector and Please credited the work of all firefighters and other emergency personnel present. For their efforts, Rector and Please received their department's second-highest award, the Medal of Valor. Kaiser received the third-highest honor, the Award of Commendation, while Lieutenant Chip Hack and firefighters Paul Doyle and Tad Worley were awarded citations for searching the other side of the house. Ludwig said the firefighters worked in heavy fire conditions and zero visibility. Such thick smoke that you can't see. A thermal imaging camera aided in locating the victims, Ludwig said. Firefighters also had to feel their way through the darkness. I'm extremely proud of not only these individuals, but all the firefighters' employees of what they do every day, he said. That's a story by Dave Hinton, and a really nice story about the Champaign firefighters. Thank you to all the folks out there with the Champaign Fire Department. On to our next story. This is a story by Mary Schenck. Around Interstate 80, Champaign man charged in August drive-by shooting. A Champaign man in jail in Urbana for an alleged weapons violation has been charged in a shooting last summer on Interstate 80 in Cook County. A release from the Illinois State Police Division of Criminal Investigation said Terrell D. Jackson, 30, was indicted earlier this week by a grand jury of charges of aggravated discharge of a firearm and reckless discharge of a firearm. The charges stem from an incident that happened about 5:15 a.m. August 16th on westbound I-80 at the Pulaski Road exit. State troopers learned two cars had crashed. One was hit by gunfire in the driver's side, sending it off the road, where it hit a guardrail and came to rest facing the opposite direction. The shooter's car, where shots had been fired from passenger side, also veered off the road, hit a light pole, and came to rest in the ditch. Police identified the driver of the shooter's car as Jackson, who ran away. The man driving the other car and his female passenger were unhurt. After investigating for months, state police had enough information to persuade the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to seek the indictments against Jackson for the Class 1 and Class 4 felonies. That happened Tuesday. Jackson has been in the Champaign County Jail since December 3rd, arrested by Champaign police and charged the next day with unlawful use of weapons by a felon on parole and unlawful use of weapons for allegedly having a gun with a defaced serial number. Those charges stem from a search of his apartment in the 200 block of Kenwood Road, where police were looking for evidence related to a November 23rd shooting. Reports said Champaign police found a .45 caliber handgun with its serial number defaced, 44 rounds of .45 caliber ammunition, 6 rounds of .38 caliber ammunition, a flash hider, an extended magazine, and clothing that matched the description of the clothes and the person involved in the November shooting. Jackson said he bought the gun November 23rd. He's due back in court on Tuesday on that case. Department of Corrections records show that Jackson is on parole for convictions out of Cook County for attempted armed robbery, and aggravated vehicular hijacking that happened in late 2012. So, looks like they got the right guy there. Thank you, Mary Schenck. On to our next story. Here's a story on the front page here. Pandemic nears 1 year. The title of this story is This Seat Taken. As we trudge closer to Thursday's 1 year anniversary of the term pandemic making headlines from Westville to Wuhan, there's a growing sense of optimism that Illinoisans may soon be able to gather outdoors in groups larger than 50. Here's editor Jeff DeLaCessia's quick look at the loosening of rules and restrictions on this day 360 of the pandemic. The summer events are fair game, with Illinois' 7-day positivity rate down to 2.4% for a 6th straight day. State Controller Susana Mendoza said Thursday she's hopeful that outdoor events like the state fair can resume as early as summertime, with large indoor gatherings, conventions, trade shows returning in the fall. So good news there for the state fairs. IHSA, all quiet on the football front. We may know more following Monday's ISSA board meeting, but so far, mom's been the word for any fan plan for the March 19th kickoff of high school football. Among the limited guidance issued by Illinois Department of Public Health, sports organizers should direct all individuals to refrain from shouting, singing, or chanting. Let's hope we get fans out to those high school games. I know I want to see one. Illini, donors have a chance. If you give $6,000 or more annually to the iFund cause, good news arrived Thursday. You may be in line to get an all-sessions ticket to next week's Big Ten men's basketball tournament in Indianapolis. The conference will allow up to 8,000 fans inside Lucas Oil Stadium, with schools able to choose how to distribute their allotment. In addition to donors, 50 tickets go to U of I students. Major League Baseball Cardinals open their doors. Masked humans will join cardboard cutouts and Busch Stadium stands for St. Louis Cardinals home games, the team announced Thursday. Season ticket holders will get first crack at reserving seats for April's first two homestands, when Busch will be up to 32% full. So far, 14 of 30 Major League teams have signed off on allowing a limited number of fans inside the gates on opening day. And in Chicago, boost for indoor dining. White Sox season ticket holder and Windy City Mayor Lori Lightfoot said this week that she expects both Chicago baseball teams to let fans in at some point this season, but didn't commit to any specifics. In the same announcement, Chicago bars and restaurants got a bit of a break. They can now increase indoor capacity from 25 to 50% or 50 people, whichever is less. So good news there on the pandemic front. It appears we're turning the corner, so let's hope we keep that momentum. Let's go on to our next story. On to our next story. This is out of Tolono, about the Tolono house fire. The story title is Family Feeling the Love in Wake of Tragedy. This is a story by Dave Hinton out of Tolono. Amanda Fulfer is gratified by the response of her fellow Tolono residents who have stepped forward to help her family after a fire Tuesday afternoon destroyed their home on Meadow Lane. A number of people have donated clothing, food, and money to help take a little of the sting out of the tragedy that wrecked their house and took the lives of three their three dogs, Tyson, Stormy, and Bob. It's been really an outpouring, Fulfer said. The community's been amazing. Both of our work has been amazing. It's just overwhelming to imagine all the things that have been offered to us already. Fulfer bought the house 20 years ago and added a 900-square-foot addition. She lived there with her fiancé, Ryan Swanson, as well as her daughter, with Swanson's four children staying part-time. They are now all staying at her father's home just across the street. No one was home at the time of the fire, which was reported just after 3 p.m. by a passerby. Fulford said she will rebuild. The fire rekindled Thursday. Tolono Assistant Fire Chief Chris Humer said there are a couple of small flares, which he said is not uncommon. Firefighters were on the scene for about an hour. Fulfer said she and her daughter were returning from a trip to Dallas to pick up two kittens they were adopting, and their plane had just touched down in Bloomington when she got the news of the fire. She said her daughter's boyfriend had left the house about 90 minutes before the fire called. The cause is thought to be electrical in origin, she said. A GoFundMe account has been set up for the family. As of Wednesday, more than $4,000 has been contributed. The Giving Place in Tolono has donated clothing that Diane Ducey delivered. We are glad to be able to help the Fulfer family with clothes and food when they reach out with their needs, said Donna Downen of the Giving Place. Contributions of all kinds are also being accepted at Monocle's at 102 West Vine Street. Beth Swigert, who owns a pizza restaurant with her husband Tom, said they don't know the family but wanted to help. I had been talking to some family members of hers and heard they lost pretty much everything, Swigert said. Everybody's been so giving. The community's been coming together. She said many have been calling, wanting to write checks for the family and asking about clothing sizes. Swigert said when she spoke with Fulfer by phone, she said, I don't know where to start. I'm going to Walmart to get toothbrushes. Fulfer is grateful for everyone's thoughts and prayers and gifts, saying we had a lot of love given to us in just the last 24 hours from people we don't even know. And there's a picture here of the Tolono Assistant Fire Chief Kyle Hayden making his way out of a house in the 1200 block of Meadow Lane on Thursday after battling a flare-up that destroyed the family home of the Fulfers. So God bless the Fulfer families, and great job to everybody in Tolono contributing. On to our next story. Let's talk a little national news here. This is a story out of Washington. Authorities grapple with security after plot. The Pentagon is reviewing a police request to keep National Guard troops patrolling the U.S. Capitol for another 60 days following evidence of a possible plot by a militia group to storm the building again, 2 months after supporters of then-President Donald Trump smashed through windows and doors in an insurrection meant to halt the certification of Joe Biden's presidential victory. There were no signs of disturbance Thursday at the heavily secured building with Capitol Police and National Guard members on duty, and the streets and grounds around the building closed off with an imposing razor wire top fence erected after the January 6th riot. There is also no evidence of a large group heading to Washington despite the warning. Still, the threat distressed law enforcement officials who are grappling with how best to secure the Capitol after a dismal showing in January when rioters sent lawmakers fleeing the iconic building in a stunning siege broadcast around the world. Five people died in the riot, including a Capitol police officer and a woman shot by police. Several investigations are underway into security and intelligence failures, and lawmakers have asked for a long-term plan for when the Guard eventually withdraws. Right now, there are about 5,200 remaining Guard members in D.C., the last of the roughly 26,000 who were brought in for Biden's inauguration, which went off with no problems. Members of both parties complain that the fence encircling the Capitol seals off access to constituents and the general public, projecting an image at odds with the seat of American democracy. The most recent threat appeared to be connected to a far-right conspiracy theory, mainly promoted by supporters QAnon, that Trump would rise again to power March 4th and thousands would come to Washington, D.C. to try to remove Democrats from office. The date was the original inauguration day until 1933, when it was moved to January 20th. But Trump was 1,000 miles away in Florida. In Washington, on one of the warmest days of the week, the National Mall was almost deserted, save for joggers, journalists, and a handful of tourists trying to take photos of the Capitol Dome through the fencing. The House had been expected to have a light schedule, but called off its session late Wednesday to wrap up its work in part of the threat. The Senate remained in session Thursday, debating Biden's COVID-19 relief bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California, Democrat, dismissed the silliness of the alleged plot to restore Trump. Still, she said, with the threat of all the president's men out there, we have to ensure with our security that we are safe enough to do our job, but not impeding Congress. That's a story out of Washington, so let's keep things safe out there. On our next story, we're going back to Mary Schenck. Vermilion County Metropolitan Enforcement Group. Possession of meth nets Danville man 10 years. A Danville man who's been in police custody for more than 3 years was sentenced Tuesday in Vermilion County City Court to 10 years in prison for methamphetamine possession. Vermilion County State's Attorney Jacqueline Lacey and said Richard D. Ford, 44, formerly of the 600 block of Winkler Road, pleaded guilty before Judge Charles Hall to a Class X felony, alleging he had more than 200 grams of methamphetamine on November 28, 2017. Lacey said Ford had been under investigation by members of the Vermilion County Metropolitan Enforcement Group. Police had information that there would be a large amount of drugs at Ford's home, obtained a court-ordered search warrant for his residence, and found the drugs. Lacey said there were multiple motions filed on behalf of Ford that prolonged the case. In exchange for his guilty plea, other charges of possession and delivery of cannabis, delivery of methamphetamine, and possession of a weapon by a felon were dismissed. Ford has been in custody since his arrest November 28, 2017. Under truth in sentencing laws, he is eligible for day-for-day good time and has already served 3 years and 3 months. Court records show he has convictions in Vermilion County dating to 1993 for burglary, possession with intent to deliver cannabis, aggravated fleeing and eluding, and aggravating driving under suspension. So it looks we got the right man there. Thank you, Mary. And let's go on to our next bit here. This is called Ask the Admin. This is a daily question for the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District's Julie Pride. And here's the question. I've driven by the Carly testing site more than once recently and saw it nearly empty. There was just one car in line when I went by last weekend. Is there a concern that the testing locations we have in the community will close or reduce hours a lot if they're used much less? Testing locations will continue to operate as long as there is a demand and need for testing. Even though the demand for testing is currently down for a variety of reasons, there is still a significant need to identify cases as soon as possible to limit spread. The current testing sites are also able to detect probable COVID-19 variants that are far more contagious. We strongly encourage anyone who has symptoms of COVID-19 to get tested as soon as possible. If someone has been vaccinated but had a known exposure, we still encourage testing. So we're turning the corner, but don't let your guard down, according to this story. Thank you. Well, we're going to take a short break now, and then we'll return with the second half hour of the News Gazette. Please stay tuned.